I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here today for Leonard Lopate after his roast of last night, which was quite wonderful. And I'm here on a day where the sun is not shining, although you can feel it through the clouds. But if you live in our neighborhood in the New York area, you probably can remember the moment after the torrential rains of about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, when the sun finally came out. And then the weather became warm and the crocuses and the daffodils came out and our hearts began to lift. A fresh spring day can make one feel happy. But is my feeling of happiness the same as someone else's? Does it come from the same place? Might it last as long or feel as strong? Happiness is both matter of fact and every day. If we're lucky, we all feel it every day. And it's also amazingly complex and mysterious. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about the scientific study of happiness and the question of whether we can actively change our own level or experience of happiness. I'm joined by phone by Dr. Sonia Lubomirsky. She's a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and the author of many journal articles on the subject and study of happiness, as well as a book, The How of Happiness, that's published by Penguin. Welcome, Dr. Lubomirsky, to the Leonard Lopate Show.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I know you're one of the authors who wrote a definition of happiness for the Oxford Companion to Emotion and Affective Sciences. How do you define happiness?
Well, it's a great question. Most researchers define happiness as something that has really two parts to it, two components. And the first component is the experience of positive emotions. You know, people who are happy are more likely to experience joy, pride, affection, curiosity, contentment. But that's not enough. The second component is a sense that your life is going well, that you're progressing towards your life goals, that you're satisfied with your life. So that sort of makes up happiness.
And does happiness need to be measured, as you're just talking about? Those are qualities. But in a sense, does it need to be measured against its opposite, which is sadness?
No, it does not. And in fact, you know, happiness and sadness can co-occur. It's not necessarily the opposite.
Oh, that's interesting. Sadness. In what kind of a situation might happiness and sadness happen at the same time?
Well, for example, bittersweet emotions are really emotions that have both kind of positive mm-hmm. and negative components. You know, so you might see your sister, but that and makes you happy, but it also reminds you that your other sibling has passed away. So researchers tend to, you know, measure emotions at the same time and not put them kind of on opposite ends of the scale.
I want to just let our listeners know that if you have a question, give us a call, a question about happiness. Our number is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. That's the Leonard Lopate show page. Dr. Lubomirsky, how is happiness related to what someone would say is their well-being?
Well, well-being and happiness are really just the same. They're just synonyms. Well-being generally is a little bit broader. So, for example, physical well-being, your physical health, can be part of well-being.
And so you might be able to be physically well but unhappy.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Or happy even if you're sick.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It seems there's been a great surge of interest in the study of happiness. There have been a number of articles. I know there's a new book by Derek Bach that's out right now. And just over the last 20 years or so, has this become a subject of more interest in the academic community?
Yeah, it absolutely has. You know, when I started doing research on happiness, it was about 20 years ago. And it was very few people studying it at the time, and I really felt kind of insecure. You know, I felt that it was considered kind of a fuzzy, unscientific topic. But since then, there's been just this huge explosion of interest in happiness from scientists and really all areas, you know, psychologists, but also economists, as Derek Bach's book shows, sociologists, anthropologists, even neuroscientists.
Why did you begin were you a young researcher then? Why did you choose happiness as your
focus? You know what?
It
was really pretty serendipitous. I mean, I should say happiness, of course, is a topic that's, you know, inherently interesting to many, many people. And the first day of graduate school, I went to Stanford University to get my PhD. I met with my advisor, Lee Ross, who was an expert on conflict and negotiation. So really quite a different subject from happiness. And we started talking about, you know, what is happiness and what is the secret to happiness? Just sort of started talking, and it went from there.
I'm listening to your voice, and granted it's over the phone lines, but it sounds like a happy voice, and maybe I'm wrong, but how would you qualify yourself? Are you a happy person?
I'm, yeah. Yeah, I'm generally a happy person. I'm not super happy, but I think I'm above average.
And, you know, it's funny, as we talk about this, I think sometimes happiness may have a negative connotation. It's like, if you're really happy, then are you really doing what you're supposed to be doing in the
world?
Yeah,
you know, it's a really great point, because people, there are these sort of myths and negative connotations to happiness. It's like that happy people aren't really thoughtful, kind of ignorance and bliss. But really, research shows that happiness is associated with a lot of positive characteristics. I mean, happier people are actually more creative, they're more energetic, they're better leaders, they're healthier, they're more likely to get things done than less happy people.
So that story about the despondent artist and that the despair may be the thing that feeds the art may not actually be true.
Well, I think there's some truth to that for some people, although when you're in the depth of depression, you're not going to be able to, you know, get off the couch, so you won't be able to sort of make great art. But there's probably some truth that you can get some kind of insights when you're experiencing sorrow that might translate into when you're feeling better and you have the energy to actually create art or literature. But even if that's true for the truly brilliant among us, you know, like John Keats or someone like that, it doesn't mean that it's true for the rest of us.
I am speaking with Dr. Sonia Lubomirsky. She's professor of psychology at the University of California in Riverside, and she focuses on happiness. If you have a question, give us a call. Our number is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Dr. Lubomirsky, can you help us become familiar with some of the different disciplines at the center of the new research about happiness? I understand there's a wide range from psychiatry and psychology to, as you say, economics and even theology.
Sure. Well, psychology is certainly at the center of it. You know, we're studying, people like myself are studying, you know, what is happiness and how can people become happier? We're doing clinical trials, in a sense, to test whether happiness can be increased. Economists are interested in questions about, for example, public policy. You know, how do we increase the happiness of our citizens? And what is more important to measure, happiness or economic indicators? There's very little research in neuroscience, but there's some that is beginning to look at whether, you know, people who are, say, happier have different kinds of brain activity. Do their brains look different from people who are less happy? And even in clinical psychology or psychiatry, researchers are interested in, you know, when you're trying to treat someone who has pathological levels of sadness or anxiety or anger, maybe increasing positive emotions or increasing well-being might actually be an alternative way to treat their symptoms, and as a supplement to also trying to fix the problems that they're having.
It's interesting saying that. I know with depression, say they often say, get out, go for a walk, be in the sun, that there are activities that could increase your well-being that they think perhaps could help with your emotional state as well.
That's right, and it's a really important point. So Barbara Fredrickson is a researcher who has shown that positive emotions can serve as an antidote to negative emotions. If we are depressed, we don't want to just kind of get undepressed and try to ameliorate.
We don't want to just be neutral. We want to go someplace else.
Right. We want to go above zero. So doing something that's engaging and at least mildly positive and fun, being with people who you know make you happy, or being in the sun, or listening to music that you like or makes you happy, can really go a long way to sort of neutralize some of the negative feelings and distract from them.
I'd like to go to one of our callers now. So I'm going to go to Amy in Manhattan. You have a question for us.
Hi, and actually in response to the last statement, I've often used Benny Goodman's Carnegie Hall concert as my mood lifter.
That is a wonderful mood lifter.
And I wanted to ask about the distinction between being happy in reaction to something good that happened or to the weather or whatever, and happiness is sort of your, some people seem to have that as their basic state, you know, state of mind.
And, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. You know, the research is showing that there is such a thing as I guess you can call it a set point for happiness. That some of us are just born happier than others, and so part of our happiness is genetically determined. And so there's certainly, when you look around you, you see that some people just have kind of a general predisposition to experience more or fewer positive emotions. So that's certainly the case. But that doesn't mean that we are doomed, you know, to experience that level that we're born with. And so we could actually, through, you know, life circumstances or through our intentional activities, we can actually do things, you know, or try to improve our lives in such a way that will make us happier. So sort of both aspects are true.
In your own work, it sounds like that is something you have focused on, is there a way we can lift our set point? And have you found that there are things that people can do to kind of increase their baseline of happiness?
Right. So what we're studying with my students and my collaborators is it possible to lastingly increase happiness? And I argue, you know, our set point is just what it is. That's what we're born with, just like we have blue eyes or, you know, we're tall or we're short. But it doesn't mean that we can't sort of change our happiness level. And so what my students and I do is they're basically like clinical trials where we or experiments where we get people, we prompt individuals to try different happiness-increasing strategies or engage in activities that make them happier, and then we follow them across time to see if that works, just like you might give someone a drug to see what kind of effect it has over time.
And what kind of activities have you found seem to increase people's happiness? What are the things you look at?
There's probably hundreds. You know, in my book, The How of Happiness, I have a different chapter for different activities that have been scientifically supported to be effective. And so these are things like doing acts of kindness on a regular basis, or keeping a gratitude journal, you know, expressing gratitude on a regular basis, or trying to be more forgiving, or engaging in physical exercise or meditation. And what's going to work is going to depend on the individual and their circumstances, right? So some people find, you know, expressing gratitude really, really effective. Other people, actually, like myself, find it kind of hokey. So it's sort of, you have to, in fact, my book has a way to determine a kind of a diagnostic that helps people determine what strategies will be more successful for them.
I know there's a book out right now by Gretchen Rubin, a project about happiness, and on her video she talks about just an everyday thing that of taking her daughter to school and finding it really annoying until one day she realized, no, this is what life is.
Yeah.
And as she started paying attention to it in a different way, it became actually a true pleasure of every day. Is paying attention in a different way something also that can help us become
happier? Yeah, attention, and I want to say Gretchen's book is really, it's really nice. I read it. Attention is really critical. You know, William James, who's considered the father of psychology, has a quote that's something like, attention is what you experience. Like, what you pay attention to is your life. You know, if you don't pay attention to something, it's as though it doesn't exist. So absolutely, it's all about redirecting your focus on what is positive. I mean, it doesn't mean that you should always be doing that. Sometimes we need to focus on our problems. Directing your attention on the good in life is very important.
We have another caller. This is Jeremy in Manhattan. You have a question for Dr. Lubomirsky.
Hi, I'm a PsyD student at Yeshiva University, and I'm taking a class with Bill Arsenio now. You may know him from childhood aggression research. Mm-hmm. But recently we were talking about some of the happiness research at set points and whatnot. And we were trying to get to the bottom of the connection between happiness and wealth. And to really, you know, not just be simplistic about it and say money doesn't make you happy, money does. And I was just wondering what your take on the research on that area is.
Thank you. That's a great question. It really is a very complicated question. In fact, the media often really simplify it. They'll say, you know, money doesn't make you happy, or money does make you happy, and it's really much more complicated than that. And I guess the bottom line is the research shows that there is a correlation between wealth and happiness. You know, people who have more money are happier. But that correlation is much, much stronger at the lowest levels, you know. So when you don't have your basic needs met, you know, like shelter, you know, safety, healthcare, you're going to be very unhappy. Once your basic needs are met, that the correlation between money and happiness is a lot smaller, but it's still there. So even the very wealthiest, you know, the billionaires are happier than the millionaires, and are healthier too. And so I guess the bottom line, I think, is that money really can make you happy, even at the higher levels, you know, if you spend it right, if you spend it on things that, you know, contribute to society, that enhance your relationships, that keep you engaged in your work or your hobbies. So it really sort of depends what you spend your money on.
So it sounds like happiness is, in a sense, relational, too. As you say, the things you spend your money on, which what you're talking about is things that might increase other people's happiness or help the world, that can help make you happier?
That's right. And, you know, I have a chapter in my book about how acts of kindness and generosity and charity make people happier, make people feel really good about themselves, and they also contribute to the world and to their communities. And also, the other point being made is that when we spend money on material possessions, those things do make us happy. I mean, they give you that burst. You know, everyone has experienced it. When you buy a new car or you buy a new bag or shoes or whatever it is, you get that burst of happiness. But the problem is, because of a phenomenon called hedonic adaptation, that happiness doesn't last. You know, we adapt to the thrill of the new shoes or the new car, whereas the happiness that comes from our relationships or from our hobbies or from our work or from contributing to society, it's much more, you know, it's self-perpetuating. It lasts a lot longer.
It's, you know, as you were talking about this, it almost sounds like drug addiction, you know, that stuff, you become addicted to it, and so then do you need more stuff in order to get that burst of happiness again?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the term that researchers use is you get on the hedonic treadmill, which is kind of like that addiction. You're on the treadmill, and then it makes you happy to have a certain amount of stuff, and then you get used to it, so then you want more to get the same level of happiness. And I also call it the Elvis Presley effect, because that's, you know, from what I've read, that's what happened to Elvis.
Well, and also, I know I've read you have children, I have children. I see it in the sort of desire for acquisition of, for my kids, it's cards. It's these mm-hmm. various trading cards that they get. And so that, though, makes me wonder, you talked about the connection between happiness and wealth. What about between happiness and consumption? It sounds like that's more complicated and possibly not as positive.
Well, exactly, because wealth, you know, you could spend your wealth on, you know, on charity or philanthropy, but consumption is that's what leads to the hedonic treadmill, as I was talking about. Interesting, you mentioned children, because children really are like little materialists. I mean, they love stuff, you know, whether it's cards or dolls or video games, and it's very hard to kind of teach them that the thrill doesn't last and that you want to put your effort into, you know, the things that really do last.
I'm speaking with Sonia Lubomirsky about the science of happiness on this week's Please Explain here on the Leonard Lopate Show. If you have a question, you can call us at 212-433-9692 or leave a comment on our show page, and we're going to speak more about happiness after a break. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Dr. Sonia Lubomirsky. She is professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and the author of The How of Happiness from Penguin. Dr. Lubomirsky, just before the break, we were talking about kids, and one of the things that I've been wondering about the idea of happiness is the relationship, the relational aspect of it, and how technology may be affecting happiness. Is that something that you've looked at as we move towards this connecting to people through technology and not face-to-face? Does that affect our happiness?
You know, I haven't looked at that empirically, you know, in research, but I certainly have some thoughts about that. I think that when technology distracts us or diverts our focus from our relationships, then I think it can hurt our happiness. On the other hand, what I've read is that, you know, there are a lot of lonely people out there, a lot of people who have various problems or addictions or mental health conditions that are able to connect with support groups, you know, for example, through the web and online groups. Mm-hmm. And so their social lives have improved, you know, with technology. And then people also have, you know, been able to maintain and develop new hobbies, you know, through technology. So in that sense, it can improve our happiness.
So I guess like wealth, it depends on how you use it.
Exactly.
I'd like to go to another call. This is a call from Steve in Port Chester. You had a question for Dr. Lubomirsky.
Yes, thank you. My question is, if you're familiar with any research that looking at happiness in, say, cities versus suburbs, and so that people in walkable communities have more access to physical activity, access to parks and cafes, informal social interactions, connections with neighbors, less time in traffic, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And there actually has been a study that came out pretty recently that looked at regional differences in happiness. And it found that basically support for what you're saying, it found that some of the lowest levels of happiness are actually in major urban areas like New York and Los Angeles, sort of where I am and where you guys are. Now, it's so complicated to try to understand. I mean, I love living where I live, and I don't want to live in a rural area. Other people disagree. So it's very complicated to try to understand what that is at the root of that difference. Obviously, the type of people who are drawn to move to major cities versus small towns are going to be different. And so it's really, really hard to explain.
You know, as we go through life, and the Constitution itself says that we should be free to pursue happiness. But how important is happiness to our lives? There are all these other things that go on in our lives in terms of making careers for ourselves and getting education. We focus on a lot of other things. Is it important for us to be looking at happiness as well as we pursue these things?
You know, absolutely. And I think they have a couple of answers to that. One is that most people in the world, if you survey them, will say that happiness is very important to them. And you could even kind of, it's sort of defined as something that we all generally are pursuing. I mean, when we're pursuing a career, what are we really doing? But you know, we're trying to find something that we think will make us happy. So you can certainly think of it that way. And then, you know, I alluded to some research that shows that people who are happier, accrue lots of good things in life. So if you're happier, you're going to make more money. You're going to be more productive at work. People will like you more. Happier people are more likely to get married. They have stronger immune systems. They're better leaders. They're better negotiators. So happiness can also help you be successful in life, in your relationships, in your work life, in your health. And so I do think it's very important. It's not just sort of a hedonistic thing, and it's all about pleasure. I think it's about a lot of other domains in life.
I've been reading some reports. The Elizabeth Colbert in The New Yorker had an mm-hmm. article about Derek Bach's book and another book about happiness, that happiness sometimes is not necessarily linked to wealth or a high standard of living. I think the paradox of the happy peasant. Can you talk about that a bit, that there may be people who from the outside you may think, wow, they really don't have very much, but they report themselves that they're very happy.
And absolutely. And when we were talking before about how there's not a really huge correlation between wealth and happiness, I mean, that's where it comes from, because there are people who, you know, we look at their lives and we think, you know, how can they be happy? They don't have, you know, the modern conveniences that we have or you know, the safety nets that we have. But I think it shows, and I have a friend and researcher, Robert Biswas-Diener, who goes around the world to different communities. He travels to like the ghetto in Bombay and different communities where he finds really happy people who are very poor. And what he shows is that, those people basically they make their happiness from what they have, from their relationships. I mean, you could have great, you know, relationships and families and children that make you really happy despite the fact that you don't have a lot of sort of conveniences in life. On the other hand, we don't want to idealize that because you know, sort of not having safety or not having security, not knowing kind of like how you're going to feed the kids, makes people very unhappy. So we have to sort of be careful trying to understand that.
One of our listeners wrote into us and wondered if I use a prescribed medication like an antidepressant or a stimulant in order to function better and actually feel more upbeat and hopeful, can I legitimately call myself more happy at those times?
You know, absolutely. And, you know, you are happier at those times. And I think there's sort of some misconceptions that people feel that, well, if I'm getting happiness or less depression, less anxiety from a drug, that somehow that doesn't count or doesn't have value or makes me sort of not as good a person. And I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, often we need that help, you know, if the neurotransmitter levels in our brains are sort of not set properly, we need that sort of extra help. And then once our depression levels are decreased, then we can go and do things ourselves that can really be self-perpetuating, and we can bring happiness into our own lives in a way that's more self-perpetuating, because with a drug, of course, you have to keep taking it for it to continue to be effective.
We have a couple of questions from listeners about children, and I'm going to go to Andrea in Hopewell Junction. You had a question about your child.
Hi. I have a son. He's three. He's very conversational, and I have noticed that in picking him up from his daycare at the end of the day, over the past few months, he's very much focused on the negative parts of his day, whether, you know, some children had gotten in an argument or pushed each other or what he didn't like in his lunchbox. And I've been working with him to really just steer the conversation towards the much more positive things, like who did he play with and what did he like about his day. And I was just wondering if you had any studies or research done on children at that age of being able to train them to really be appreciative and gracious about their day and about their life in general.
Thank you. That's a great question. You know, and I'm not a child psychologist, but I know there is some research on children, not that young, but I think you're doing exactly the right thing. That you can, even though, I mean, it's possible that he is a little bit, you know, less optimistic, less positive, or less happy, kind of by nature. And lots of us are. You know, many people are. Probably half the world is. And so, but we can train ourselves to be more positive, more optimistic. Look at the bright side, be more grateful, but it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of practice. I mean, I often make an analogy with weight loss. You know, some people are just born with a higher set point for weight, and they can lose weight. They just have to work harder at it. So if you try to teach him those kind of strategies, like how to look on the bright side when something bad happens, how to cope and be resilient, I think over time that he could really learn and sort of practice those strategies. And probably as he gets older, it'll be easier, you know. But, you know, the earlier you start, the better.
Andrea's question made me think of one of my own kids. When I pick him up from school, he usually is very cranky and very unhappy. And I've learned that once he has a banana and a little bit more of a snack, he turns into his usual cheerful self.
I love that.
Do you find that that's true for many people, that hunger and that sort of external circumstances can affect that set point in a way?
Yeah, well, certainly. Well, the set point is just something that's set, but it certainly can affect your level of happiness, and we have to be really aware of it. It's like in a relationship, in a marriage. Sometimes we just know we're going to get into a fight when we're in a certain mood or when we're tired, and then we need to just wait it out, you know, wait until you feel more neutral and more positive. And the same thing goes for what's called rumination or overthinking. A lot of us kind of dwell and overthink, and we sort of think about all these negative thoughts, and we just need to realize that there's certain times of the day, maybe when we're hungry or when we're tired or when we're commuting or whatever, or when we're going to bed, that we tend to sort of overthink or ruminate, and that we need to kind of distract ourselves at that time and try to go back to thinking about our problems when we're a little bit more neutral. So I think it's about self-experimentation and learning about yourself and what situations make you happy and what make you unhappy, and sort of that awareness, I think, is a first step.
So it's not just paying attention to the outside world, but the inside world, too, and
that's
what,
right, really both, yeah.
How that changes. I'd like to go to another question. This is from George in Manhattan. George?
Hey, how are you?
Hi.
I'm very interested in your research, and I've done some of my own, and I want to share it with you and get your impressions.
Okay.
First of all, I see a very strong relationship between achievement and happiness in children, especially. Kids who achieve in school tend to be a lot happier than kids who don't achieve. And what I mean by achievement is a kid who has a very high intelligence level, say he gets over 85th percentile on the California test of mental maturity, to, you know, use something mm-hmm. that's from Riverside, or he does very well on the academic promise test, or he does well on the Iowa test of basic skills. But his grade point average is way below what it should be based on those intelligent levels or achievement levels or, let's say, capability levels.
So that the gap between what a child is capable of and what they achieve, if that is a large gap, they may be more unhappy?
Sure, that stands in the way of their happiness. If they start, for instance, with a great deal of expectation from their parents that they should be doing such and such, gee, I took my kid and got him tested, and he should be doing this and that and something else, or the school, he's put into a school where he has a very high achievement requirement.
Well, Dr. Lubomirsky, what do you think about that, the connection between achievement and happiness?
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting question. First, I guess I reiterate that there's no correlation between happiness and intelligence. Just, you know, if you look at IQ. But yeah, there is a correlation between happiness and, I guess, sort of achievement or success in life, whether it's, you know, academic success or when you're, you know, when you're working, your productivity. And but the causality is unclear. I think the causality probably goes both ways. I mean, when you're getting straight A's, that's going to make you happier. But also people who are naturally happier, no matter what their intelligence level is, they're going to achieve more. They're going to have more energy. They're going to be more motivated. They're going to get more help, you know, because happier people get more social support. And so absolutely, there is that correlation between happiness and achievement.
Are there moments, you know, I'm thinking about a moment in my own life just a few weeks ago where a friend died and I felt really terrible. And then the sun came out a few days later and I started feeling a little better, and I started feeling a little guilty for actually feeling better. Are there moments in people's lives where the idea of happiness just doesn't feel right?
Well, of course, you know, and there's lots of social norms about that. There's certain situations that you should not be expressing or feeling happiness. And in fact, there's some research that came out recently that shows that people who are too happy, like sort of a 10 on a scale of 10, can suffer in certain areas, like in work productivity. You know, like if you're, and basically it's this idea that, you know, when you're passionately in love and you're just so ecstatic that you can't get any work done, you know, that, and also people can perceive you negatively, and obviously you shouldn't be expressing happiness at funerals or when someone else gets a bad grade and you get a good grade. So there's certainly lots of social norms about that, about, you know, when you should be expressing and experiencing happiness.
But you're saying people who have a 10 out of 10, that they may not be as productive as other people, or that what did you find
That's
about
right.
those people?
That's right. There's just one study that showed that, so if you're a 10 out of 10, you're going to be a little bit less productive at work than, say, an 8 out of 10. So it's not saying that you shouldn't be happy, but if you're just sort of super happy. On the other hand, the same study showed that the 10s had better relationships, were very happy in their relationships, which sort of shows that when it comes to relationships, the happier the better. You know, we all know what it's like to be with a partner who's unhappy. It really brings us down, brings the whole relationship down.
As we're talking about this, I'm thinking this is just so challenging. It must be so challenging to measure, because are there any external ways of measuring happiness, or is it all self-reported? I feel happy today.
You know, it really is self-reported almost always. You know, unfortunately, there's no thermometer for happiness or some kind of, you know, physiological indicator just yet. I mean, the people who are happy do show somewhat different brain activity, so they have more activity on the left side of the frontal cortex than the right. But we don't really know what that means. So generally researchers ask people, you know, how happy are you? They ask them in different ways with different scales that have been validated. And, you know, to tell you the truth, I mean, we all know how happy we are. I mean, I think it's very rare to find someone who sort of has no idea or who's lying. And so we generally trust people's self-reports and intuitions.
Is this something that you found either with your subjects as you're working with them or in your own life, where this actually can be changed, the set point can be changed? We just have a couple of seconds.
Sure, it can. I would say the set point can be changed because that is set, but your happiness level can be changed through a lot of effort. You know, if you do more acts of kindness or try to be more optimistic or more grateful or focus on your relationships or your goals at work with a lot of effort and commitment, all of us can become happier.
That's lovely to know.
Mm-hmm.
I've been speaking with Dr. Sonia Lubomirsky. She is professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and the author of The How of Happiness from Penguin. And Dr. Lubomirsky, thank you so much for joining me to talk about something I think we all would like more of, which is happiness.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.